It is Friday, May the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, lots of eyes on France in this weekend's presidential election.
This is very much a bellwether of the direction in which global politics are moving. It's even more important for Europe because France is so central to the European project. And by that, I mean the project of European economic and political integration.
Also ahead, efforts to repeal the existing U.S. health care plan in the U.S., plus educating the children of South Sudan, social media trends, and a new film starring Richard Gere. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Round two of France's presidential election set for Sunday, and the choices are either Marine Le Pen, a far-right populist, or Emmanuel Macron, who is seen as a moderate. The outcome of Sunday's presidential runoff hinges on the millions of voters, some who are repelled by both candidates, who must make a choice whether to hand Macron his expected victory or stay home and risk handing Le Pen a surprise win. Observers are saying the choice will ripple across Europe's open borders through the global financial markets onto the battlefields of Syria and Ukraine and around the halls of UN diplomacy. International Edition's Laurie London asked Desmond Dynan, a professor of European public policy at George Mason University, why this election has implications far beyond the borders of France.
Because the contest in France is between a populist, Marine Le Pen, and a globalist, Emmanuel Macron. And that mirrors the division which seems to be emerging globally. For instance, we had a similar contest in the United States not so long ago, and of course in the United Kingdom, the referendum on Brexit. So this is very much a bellwether of the direction in which global politics are moving. It's even more important for Europe because France is so central to the European project, and by that I mean the project of European economic and political integration. It's one thing for the United Kingdom to decide to leave the European Union. But if France were to be led by a President Le Pen, who is, to say the least, equivocal about the European Union, who thinks that France should withdraw from the euro and have a referendum on whether to remain in the European Union, I think it could possibly be the death knell of the European Union itself.
It looks like Macron has taken a lead in the polls. Maybe not a huge lead, but a lead. How accurate are the polls normally in that part of the world?
They are more accurate than they were in the UK when it came to the Brexit referendum and the United States when it came to the presidential referendum. And the polls quite accurately reflected the outcome of the first round of polling in the French presidential election. The polls predicted quite accurately that Macron and Le Pen would be in the second round. The two leaders from the first round contest the second round against each other, and they quite accurately predicted the percentage of votes that each candidate would receive. And so I think it's fair to say that the polls are accurate, and they are predicting that Macron will win, and I think he will win. From Le Pen's point of view, let me put it like this. Macron is predicted to win by double digits, perhaps by a 20% lead, and he may do so. But if he wins by anything less than that, Le Pen can claim something of a moral victory. Of course, she will not have won the presidential election, but at least she can claim that the margin was smaller than the polls predicted. But on the other hand, as I said, the polls so far have been accurate. They are predicting about a 20% margin for Macron. The outcome might be slimmer margin than that, but I think it's pretty fair to say that Macron is going to win.
It's a pretty contentious race, very similar in some ways to what we saw here in the United States between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And there was a recent debate that I know you watched. What was your ultimate takeaway from that?
The contrast was striking between Le Pen and Macron. Le Pen is a very experienced politician. She has been on the political stage, and in fact center stage politically, for the last 15 years or so. She's a very experienced politician, very experienced campaigner. She is an excellent debater. Macron, by contrast, is new to electoral politics. He was in the outgoing government or administration of François Hollande. He was the economics minister for several years, but that was not an elected position. It was an appointed position. And then Macron took a huge gamble by resigning from the government, by launching a political party of his own, and by contesting the presidential election. So he is a novice to electoral politics, and that very much showed last night. I think he was very good. Macron was very good on the substance. whereas Le Pen was much better on the debating points. She needled him. Now, he didn't always rise to the bait, but she was very good at that. But I think in the end, she played to the gallery. She played to her supporters. Her supporters were very happy with her performance. I'm not sure that she won any new support beyond her base, which is a strong base, whereas he was more cerebral. He was more substantive. He stuck to the main policy points themselves.
If Macron does win, will that sort of indicate that maybe this populist wave that has been spreading throughout the globe may be fizzling out a bit?
I think so. And we've had an indicator that that may be the case already in Europe, because there were elections in the Netherlands not too long ago. And Geert Wilders, who's also a populist, he did well, but not as well as anticipated. And the mainstream political parties fared much better. So that was perhaps the beginning of the turning of the tide against the populists. But we shouldn't forget that even in the Netherlands, Wilders, the populist, did well. And even in France, if Le Pen is defeated, as the polls suggest and as most people expect, still the fact that she got into the second round with such a large percentage of the vote, and the fact that she will have won a large percentage of the vote, although not enough to become president of France, that suggests that populism is still a force to be reckoned with. The tide may have turned, but populism will still remain as a powerful force in European and global politics.
That is Desmond Dine, professor of European public policy at George Mason University. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday, on the Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Research is showing that over 75% of girls in South Sudan fail to get a primary school education. The NGO Plan International says both girls and boys are facing a triple tragedy in the form of brutal conflict, as well as famine and denial of their right to an education. The NGO partner of UNICEF conducted the study in 22 countries. It found that South Sudan has the highest rate of primary school-age children out of school at 72. Roland Angra is the regional director for East and Southern African at Plan International. He speaks now with VOA's Kim Lewis about the findings and what's being done to deal with the problem.
As you know, South Sudan is in dire straits as a country, and particularly the girls are suffering from a triple tragedy, which consists of a brutal conflict which has gone on for decades and has revived the last year. Famine has been declared about 2 months ago, so there's a clear food shortage and hunger, and they're also denied their rights to education. And those are the three pillars of development which we think they are deprived of, and that's why we're talking about the triple tragedy.
Research by UNICEF, your partner, finds that 76% of girls in South Sudan are not getting an education. Why are girls hit the hardest, especially during food crises?
You have to see the family traditions and cultures, and also the gender discrimination which is built into the societies. Girls are often taken out of school earlier than boys, or boys are preferred to be sent to schools because girls are needed in the household to look after siblings, to look for food, and particularly when the crisis hits, that becomes even more important. Secondly, you see girls are exposed in the areas of conflict. Gender-based violence is increasing, and their safety and security when they go to school is in danger. That's the second reason why they often don't go. And thirdly, you see also families who consider the girls just one more mouth to feed at home. And if they have the opportunity to sell them off in marriage by getting a few heads of cattle instead, they actually contribute to the income and to the food security of their own family. The girls are married at very early ages.
What is being done now to help children stay in school in South Sudan? And that would be boys and girls.
Yes, that would be girls and boys, because boys are also affected. Plan International, we are running food for education programs, which is actually give an incentive to families and to children to come to school by giving them meals in school, not only feeding themselves when they come, but also equip them with some food rations that they can take home so that families get the benefit out of it. And that definitely works well because they see there is something in for them. Of course, we also want to give them an education there. So we equip them with school supplies, and we also equip girls with sanitary facilities, because it's often also a dropout reason that they don't have sanitary facilities or access to dignity kits, as we call them, when they have the periods. We also give them counseling, particularly in areas of internally displaced people who have left their homes due to the conflict. They live in camps, in makeshift camps usually, if they have present violence and they go through traumatic situations. That's the psychosocial help we can give them.
How does education help to overcome the cycle of poverty?
That's a very profound question. I mean, we have to take into account that South Sudan is a country which, even before the conflict, had a literacy rate of around 40%. So that means 60% of the people cannot read and write. At the same time, South Sudan is not a poor country because there is fertile land, there's water, there's mineral resources. But if the population is not educated and prepared to make use of those resources, they will not get the benefits from it. So what we think, if we do not do anything for education now, we'll have another lost generation who will not be able to draw on the resources of their own country. Particularly girls' education, we think, is important because we know from experience and from studies in many other places that providing girls with education actually brings down the birth rate. We also know that over time, educated girls can generate much more income.
What does the international community need to do right now to help in South Sudan?
The humanitarian agencies, including Plan International, are working very hard on the ground and the personal security risk to actually attend to the girls and boys in that country. But we need support. We need really the moral and the financial support. Unfortunately, on the international agenda, South Sudan is dropping on the priority lists. We see the risk that it may disappear in oblivion. Help us by going to different donation webpages or to plan-international.org, where you can find the way to support us.
That is Roland Angra. He is the Regional Director for East and Southern Africa for Plan International. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
President Trump turned his first trip to his hometown of New York City since taking office into a celebration. He returned to the city that has largely opposed him while celebrating lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives passing legislation undoing much of former President Barack Obama's health care law. Before going to New York, Mr. Trump spoke at the White House.
So the journey continues. We will get it done. We will have great health care for everyone in our nation. We have an unbelievable country, But I want to thank the men and women behind me. I want to thank at least some of the men and women in front of me. And of course, I even want to thank the media. Thank you all very much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Among those who opposed the health care bill in the House of Representatives was House Minority Leader Democrat Nancy Pelosi, who spoke about the Republicans who wrote the bill and why she thinks or what she thinks they can expect.
The public will now see what they gave their name to. They put their name next to "you're paying more for less." And we'll make sure that the public is aware of that. I think they walked the plank. They were, I don't know, duped into walking the plank for a bill that will not become law. But I guess their desire to give a tax break for the rich just trumped everything.
The health care legislation now must be approved by the U.S. Senate, where some believe there are not enough votes to make the Obama health care bill replacement a law. Ed Chasteen is well known in the vicinity of his hometown, the U.S. city of Liberty, Missouri, for reaching out to victims of local hate crimes. VOA's Isha Sarai reports from Liberty that no job is too big for Chasteen, founder of the group called Hate Busters.
Hate Busters.
Dr. Ed Chasteen founded Hate Busters with a group of his students in 1988. When notorious Ku Klux Klansman David Duke was elected in Louisiana.
We talked about it for a long time, weeks, months. Finally, we decided to go there, to design this shirt, to make Ghostbusters, Hate Busters.
Since the 80s, the group's work has changed a little, but the mission remains the same.
Not long ago, in Missouri City, just 10 miles from here, somebody beat on the door of an interracial couple at night and said, "We're going to kill your kids and you." And so I heard about it. It was in the paper. I called them. We went there. They needed support.
At 81, Chasteen does not expect Hate Busters will go on forever. But Chasteen says it doesn't really matter. His ideals, he says, will live on in the lives and deeds of lots of people. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Liberty, Missouri.
And now it's time to find out what's trending on social media with International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Trending today, a new plan to vet social media for U.S. visa applicants and an internet scam that's duping thousands around the world. Let's start with that social media vetting. According to a new plan from the U.S. State Department, the United States would ask certain visa applicants to provide any social media handles they've used within the past 5 years, a move that's part of President Trump's pledge to increase scrutiny for those applying for U.S. visas. Now, this particular proposal would only target those who, according to the State Department, have been determined to warrant additional scrutiny in connection with terrorism or other national security-related visa ineligibilities, roughly 65,000 people by some estimates. Now, that being said, the State Department notes that failure to provide social media handles would not necessarily mean that a person would be barred from entering the United States. Also, it's important to keep in mind that this is just a proposal right now and has not been implemented yet. In fact, the State Department is currently seeking feedback on the plan before the Trump administration requests its implementation later this month. And a sophisticated email scam sweeping across Gmail accounts. People around the world are receiving emails from friends and family with a link to a Google Doc, which seems innocuous enough. There are millions, if not billions, of those emails sent around the world every day. The problem? The link to this particular document, which looks official, is actually a scam. Clicking on it gives the scammers access to your entire email box and address book, which they then use to send the scam to your contacts. Now, Google quickly worked to stop this, saying in a statement they were able to stop the scam within an hour of it going live by preventing those fraudulent emails from going out over their system. But in the meantime, if you do see an email with a shared Google Doc, the best bet, at least for the time being, either double-check with the sender to see if it's legitimate, or just simply hit delete.
Many thanks, Andrew. International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Persian Gulf and Middle Eastern nations have historically suffered from high youth unemployment. Today, the government and business incubators are helping young entrepreneurs like Alia Aidi get ahead. Aidi is the founder of an Arabic language cooking website, Basmati.
If I didn't have the support of the incubator, the yearly license would have been 15,000 dirhams on a yearly basis.
Public sector jobs in the oil industry dominate the Gulf region, but technology is changing the employment landscape. Online retailer Souq.com was bought by Amazon for $1 billion. Another startup, Kareem, now competes with Uber. Essa Al Zabi is with the Dubai Chamber of Commerce and says startups are gaining ground.
And it has been given extra attention and extra focus because they will be the future of any growing economies.
But entrepreneurs in the region say they need more access to credit, and hiring qualified people is still a challenge. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Well, how far would you go to protect your children? What if they had done something wrong or other people might have been hurt? Well, these are some of the questions that come up in a new movie starring Golden Globe winner Richard Gere and actress Laura Linney. VOA's David Byrd tells us that the thriller titled The Dinner revolves around choices and their consequence for two brothers.
So what's the subject at hand?
You know what it is.
It's about the boys.
How much do you know?
How much do you know?
He's going to turn us in. He's going to turn us in. I know.
These boys have committed a horrific crime.
Stan Lohman is a popular congressman running for governor. He invites his troubled younger brother Paul and his wife Claire to join him and his wife for dinner at an expensive restaurant. Stan, played by Richard Gere, and Paul, played by Oscar nominee Steve Coogan, have been estranged for years, but their sons are best friends. However, the two teenaged boys have committed a terrible crime that might never be found out. The dinner is intended to decide what to do about that. Richard Gere says the film looks at the nuances of life. What is the right thing to do, and who defines what's right and wrong, especially when several people have legitimate arguments?
All of them are defensible, and all of them are understandable. And depending on causes and conditions and circumstances, we each could follow any one of those arguments. And that's our world today. This is a world of subtle mental and emotional processes. Unlike the president we have right now, the gray area is where we actually live. So there's no right and wrong in almost any situation in our lives.
The film is based on a novel by Herman Koch. Director Oren Moverman, who also wrote and directed Time Out of Mind, Rampart, and The Messenger, wrote the screenplay. He says The Dinner wrestles with what it means to be human.
I think there's a fundamental question that's being asked in the world that we live in right now, and with the technology that we have, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to acknowledge the humanity of others? And that's really what the, you know, conversation that's coming out of this movie is about.
Rebecca Hall plays Gere's second wife, Caitlin, who is doing her best to be a mother to Gere's three children, none of which is hers. Hall says the movie shows how family dramas can have far-reaching consequences.
They're all essentially horrible people and good people at the same time. And I think that gray area is challenging to us because we all want to exist in our bubbles and assume that the people outside the bubbles are the ones who are doing the wrong thing. So to present a story that challenges your sense of black and white, right and wrong, I think is important.
Oscar nominee Laura Linney plays Claire, the wife of retired schoolteacher Paul Lohman and the mother of one of the teenaged boys. Linney says she doesn't know how she would react under similar circumstances.
I hope I would know how I would behave. I would love to say that I would take the what I feel is the ethical way to go. But I think until you're actually in that situation, I don't know what primal desire comes through. I don't think I'm a Claire, but I'm sure there's a little bit of Claire in all of us, as there is, hopefully, you know, a little bit of Richard's character in all of us as well.
The Dinner also stars Oscar nominee Chloe Sevigny as Barbara Lohman, Stan's ex-wife, and the mother of his children. The film is playing at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York and is set for wide release May 5th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, Dave. Well, it turns out that rapper Jay-Z is in a festival state of mind. That's right. Austin City Limits organizers have announced that he will be performing at their festival in October. Jay-Z will also perform during the Made in America Festival in Philadelphia. That will be later this month over the Memorial Day weekend. The performances could mean that Jay-Z is about to release new music, but his older stuff, some of the best music you'll ever hear, are super favorites.
Lady, huh. What's your name?
Love, let's go half on the sun. I know my past ain't won. You can easily get past, but that chapter is done. But I'm done reading for now. Remember space, face up, you could believe it for now. But my, you got it for real, for serious, bro. I'm about to give you all the keys and security codes. About to show you where the cheese, let you know I ain't playing. But before I jump out the window,
and to give away the security codes, well, that's not a good idea. Listen, that song is called Excuse Me, Miss Miss. It's a big song. It was for Jay-Z. It also features singer-songwriter Pharrell. We don't hear him much in that clip, but he's throughout the song. Sean Carter is the real name of Jay-Z. He's one of the best-selling musicians of all time, having sold more than 100 million records, receiving 21 Grammy Awards. A spectacular performer, married to singer-songwriter Beyoncé, a pretty good gal herself. They have one child, and guess what? They are expecting twins. Good for them. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. We remind you that the latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian government has added three more NGOs to its list of undesirables as the government's crackdown on civil society continues. The three organizations were founded or backed by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, a former Russian oil tycoon and Kremlin critic who was imprisoned for 10 years on fraud charges after a trial deemed by many international observers to be politically motivated. Khodorkovsky was pardoned in 2013 and has since lived abroad. Russia's General Prosecutor's Office banned the activities of the Open Russia Foundation, the Institute of Modern Russia, and the Open Russia Civic Movement under the 2015 Law on Undesirable Foreign Organizations, which says that groups can be prohibited from operating on Russian soil if they are seen to pose a threat to the state's constitutional order, national defense, or security. Seven U.S.-based non-governmental organizations have already been designated as undesirable under the same law. The Media Development Investment Fund, the Open Society Institute Assistance Foundation, the Open Society Foundations, the U.S.-Russia Foundation for Economic Advancement and the Rule of Law, the International Republican Institute and its sister organization, the National Democratic Institute, as well as the National Endowment for Democracy. In deploring the latest additions, Amnesty International's Russian director, Sergei Nitikin, said, "For many years, Russian authorities have relentlessly worked to create a hostile environment for civil society. Open Russia's activities in human rights defense, its support of independent candidates running for national and local elected office, and media work were a great impediment to them. By banning the organization, the authorities intend to overcome this obstacle." U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said the United States is deeply troubled by the recent designations of the three NGOs. "We reject the notion that these and other international civil society organizations are a threat to Russia. If Russia hopes to build a strong, democratic government with a dynamic, competitive economy, it should value and support, not harass and criminalize, such independent voices." The United States again calls on Russia, Mr. Toner said, to uphold its international obligations and commitments to promote and protect human rights and fundamental freedoms and to cease restrictions on the work of civil society organizations in Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.